Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Narries podcast. I'm your host, James Elnor, joined by my good friend, Timmy Lang.
Hi, everyone.
It's recovery month, our little pink ribbon, purple ribbon, and we're in Ballymun, the Axis Theatre, with Shawnee Kinsler.
That's right.
What's the crack, Shawnee?
All right, James.
You're looking well in your loafers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're only after back from a recovery run.
Just back from a 21K run with all the services in Dublin for recovery month. So we do an event every year. And it's the recovery run. So I was part of that this morning, setting it up and getting it organised, warming people up and just having a get-together, basically.
What kind of a turnout did you get?
We got a good few, yeah. We got about 50 people, all in recovery at different stages. Mm. Some early, some long time. I just had a great bit of crack.
Might be something that we can talk about down the line, doing the same thing and maybe in Cork to run on the same day. I might get something I could... Definitely get a few fellas going like that as well.
Amazing. I'd love to go down and do it on the day with ourselves.
We could barely do a good jog anyway, Johnny, if I'm honest with you.
We go with a nice light pace, 4:40, Timmy, be handy for
you. I'd need it anyway.
Well, we have it. There's a recovery academy in Cork, actually, since only last year. But because of COVID, anything that they had planned was cancelled. Do you know what I mean? So... definitely, like, the importance of something like that can't be underestimated. Like, before the Recovery Academy, or even though they're not doing anything at the moment in Cork, me and Timmy and a big group of us are telling you off camera, you know, we go to Killarney every, you know, a couple of times a year and walk through the gap of the north, about 26 kilometres up a hill down the other side. We did Caron Tool as well, the highest peak and all.
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah.
70 of us in recovery, you know, because some crack fellas that are still using, fellas that are multiple years and everything in between. But it just gives the fellas that aren't newly around or just kind of thinking about it so much, you know, encouragement. And to think like that, here's all the boys that I can relate with so much, all blood sober in recovery and the crack we're having, that you don't need drugs, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a big part of it, like.
Huge part of it, huge. Because it gives them somebody to look at and it gives them hope, which is what we lose when we're in addiction. Like, we lose that spark of hope. We don't have it. So when we see somebody that's been through what we've been through and they're doing so well, it's like, you just think, we might be able to do it.
Yeah, 100%.
I know. Do you want to give us a small bit of background on yourself, Shawnee? Just tell us where.
Yeah.
We know you're from Ballymun, but do you want to tell us how it was growing up? And
So I'm from Ballymun. I was obviously grew up here. Lived in Balbridge Alliance starting off. And I've three sisters, one older, two younger, and me mum and dad. And we lived in Balbutcher, I think, for the first 4 years of my life. And then we set the flat on fire, set it ablaze. I was messing with matches under the bed. And I was just that type of kid. I was always bleeding at stuff. I was messing and, you know, just... So we set the place on fire. The whole gaff went up.
So we didn't hurt, obviously.
No. We all got out, thank God.
Yeah.
So then we had to move from there, obviously, to Shangan Gardens, which is down this end. And that's where I started my life with me mum and dad and my three sisters. And my earliest memories of growing up are wet in the bed on a regular basis, waiting on the outlet to come in from the pub at 11:30 after the last bus. And I would have been around a lot of fear and violence and other stuff. Yeah. You know, we just grew up in that environment. And my earliest memories are, we used to have the cracks in the hall.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to have to come out of my bedroom and walk across the hall to get into the toilet. And I used to know where to step because we didn't want to make any noise in case I woke me dad. So that's how afraid I was.
Yeah.
So that was my earliest memory. And I started to, my first form, I think, of escape was I started fantasizing. So I used to like just go somewhere else in my mind when I was lying in bed because I couldn't sleep. And I think about like living in Black Rock or Fox Rock with this lovely family, and like I'd have money and I'd be in a car and I'd be around these people that were happy because I was miserable. And I was six at that time, 6 or 7, like I was only a young kid. And it was really difficult.
I can relate.
Isn't it sad to think, like you said, that you have a kid now, don't you?
Yeah, it's 3 and a half.
Yeah, can you imagine like your child lying in the bed thinking like that? You couldn't really, because the life that you're giving your child, when they're very hard, isn't it very sad to think that there is children out there in that situation right now?
100%. Yeah, lots of them. It's just the way it is.
Mm.
So yeah, it was really difficult. And when I think back, it's really sad, you know, because I had loads of ability and I had loads of potential and I was a good kid. But, you know, whatever obviously happened. And then we start, my next form of escape then obviously was smoking and solvents.
Mm.
And that's what I started to do to escape. Then as I start growing a little bit more, I started sniffing bottles of stuff underneath the kitchen sink. So Glade, other stuff. And basically that took me away from the pain of what I was living in for that few minutes. So it'd be like, I'd get an escape, if you like, which would bring me away from the bleeding, you know, the painful state I was living in. And then that progressed. And
were you in school?
In and out of school. So I was in school, but I was never present in school. I was a class clown. I was always disruptive in school and I could just never be present. I was always thinking about what the lads were going to be doing later on the block. Was there going to be a robbed car? Was there anything happening? And I'd just sit there and I'd look out the window and I literally learned nothing in school. And then I got suspended and suspended and suspended, and then I got expelled. They got rid of me out of primary school. They just didn't want me there anymore. So I'll never forget the day that the principal used to have to bring me home to the gaff. And it was the longest journey of my life going down to the house because I knew the outfit was in the house. And I swear to God, boys, I'd be fucking terrified. Literally shaking my head. But you know what? I couldn't help myself from getting expelled or suspended. I just couldn't. I couldn't be in the fucking school, like, you know. So I took that journey loads of times down, and as soon as the door would be closed and the teacher would go, I'd get it.
I can totally relate with that. You know, when I was in secondary school, I got into so much trouble in school. It was cause huge conflict for me at home with my mother, and no matter how bad I got at home, beatings or, you know, how much hassle I got into, the next day I could be in and the exact same thing would happen. I'd say something, I'd do something in class, I guess suspended again. And it was like completely related. It was like when I went into school, when I had to put on the uniform, walk in them doors, I just resisted it. Do you know what I mean? And I knew what was coming, but in that moment you can't help yourself, do you know? So it's fucking hell. And I can, you know, a lot of conflict at home, and walking in the door, you know what you're getting when you're in the door. You know, it's like, come here, you're going close to something like that. It's like, no, if the dog do something wrong and he knows he's in trouble, you're, come here, you, and he's coming over, and he's going down lower and lower. It's a bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but it's shit. You know, it's, when you think about, you know, school is meant to be the best days of your life and all that and enjoyable, but for a lot of people, school can be re-traumatizing, you know, when you're coming from troubled homes. Like,
100%.
What you do then after that?
So after that, we went to secondary school I got into secondary school in the comp, which is where I am now across the way here. And I think I lasted probably 6 months there and then I just left. I was thrown out and I think after that, I was getting into trouble with the police. I was robbing. I was getting JLOs constantly. I was taking drugs as well. And I was starting to, back then, what we used to call it was, I used to go out on go. So I would leave the house and drop out the bedroom window. And I would go for like 2 weeks and I'd stay on the streets. We used to live in the pipe box in the Hedges Tower, which is the, where the Hedge, Peter McFerry, had his first homeless flat for lads that were coming from really difficult backgrounds and that ended up on drugs at young ages. Mm. And he took them in. So we ended up on that balcony in a pipe box with a duvet and a pillow. And that's where I slept.
At the age of 12, 13?
I would have been about, 12, 13, 14, We were sleeping in pipe boxes and he used to come out and the staff used to come out and give me cups of tea and the other lads, the older lads that lived in the house were really good to me and they'd give me smokes and, you know, and after about 3 or 4 weeks then he took me into the flat and I was living there then for a while.
And were you on drugs at that stage, Sean?
Yeah, I was smoking gear at that stage,
At the age of 13?
14,
Do you know at this moment in Ballymun, if you knew there was a 12, 13, 14 year old sleeping in a pipe box with a pillow, like that would, like this is not that long ago either, do you know what I mean? But the thought of it happening today, or do you think that there is young fellas like that today in Ballymun, or do you think that that was a different time? Like good social services, well, were they involved then, or would it be quicker to be involved now?
I don't know about now, because back then it was a different environment. There was flats. It was
more hidden.
Yeah, so now it's like you can't really see the problem. But I'm sure as young fellas at that age experiencing the same thing I experienced.
Yeah.
I've no doubt. And maybe younger, possibly.
You don't really know until they start sharing their story in 20 years' time.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, so
they're just trying to survive and they're trying to live and they're trying to stay alive, basically, and deal with all of the stuff that's going on. So
when you're sleeping in that place in the flats, not in a flat but in a place within the flat complex, it was probably inevitable you're going to get caught up in hair drugs.
Guarantee, sure it was going on around me.
Mm.
People were using.
This was the '80s too, like wasn't it?
Yeah, it would have been the late '80s.
What year were you born?
1980. So it would have been the 90s. early '90s, sorry.
Yeah.
Early '90s,
yeah. There were tough times up here in Dublin. Big like time, heroin was a massive thing.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. And it was really prevalent on in this area, especially. Like you had them, like it was just crazy. So yeah, it was fucking.
And how did the heroin enter your life? Can you remember like when you first started smoking it and can you remember being sick for the first, I can remember these things, you know, I remember like.
Yeah, 100%. I can remember like it was yesterday.
Mm.
Yeah, I remember it.
And the progression from the smoking to the injecting drug use. And
unfortunately for me, James, I introduced myself to hard drugs at a really, really young age. So the progression for me happened really quick. So we didn't get any time in the dancing, going out, any of that. I didn't have that. So I went straight from being a child into
the dark side of
into
heroin.
Into the dark side of, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I went straight in, there was no...
So around that time as well, culturally, we had the rave scene, ecstasy and all that.
Yeah.
You didn't experience that.
I experienced a little bit of it, but it wouldn't have been... Like I was with the lads and we were smoking. While everyone else was going to Temple Theatre or Sides or the Asylum or the Arm and all these other places. And I just didn't get it. Like, you know, I was flung into.
Like if heroin is your drug of choice at that stage, I suppose you're hardly gonna drop the heroin to take a few ease.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No. No, definitely not.
There's no social aspect to heroin use.
No, it's isolation. But you know what? The early days of it were great. I have to say that, you know, because I loved it.
When you say it, I smile because I think it's
I loved it. I loved the excitement of it. I loved the buying it and like...
Even the robbing.
The robbing.
To get the money for it. Like, I used to love that. I used to be holding my head fucking in these... climbing into people's backyard and driving their lawnmowers and their strimmers like the way and get more money for drugs than the following day.
Yeah.
I must have done that for 6 months, I'd say, at least. I must have been buzzing for 6 months. Do you know, until, do you know, nearly fucking killed us. Like, I can understand it 100%. Even up till the end of my using, like, people were saying, what the fuck were you, what were you robbing for? Like, you have plenty, you have money. It was just, I used to get this extra bit of a high off it. I don't know, I couldn't get the high off the cork or the drink or the tablets anymore, or even crack or anything like that, or any of the other stuff. Mm. It was just, I used to get it from the robbing, the snooping. It might be nothing, but I used to just get that extra little bit of a buzz from it.
Excitement.
Like, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, and being with the boys then as well, and you know,
yeah,
and the ducking and the diving, and what the fuck,
yeah,
looking back now, I'm saying, what the fuck was I up to, like,
yeah,
but life is on the edge at every moment,
and when your life is drugs and you're getting your kicks out of crime, obviously you're going to end up in detention, in prison, whatever. Can you tell me what your first time going into prison was, the St. Patrick's or Mountjoy, and what that was like?
Yeah, so my first introduction to that would have been a place called St. Michael's. So that was for really, really young kids that were in a lot of trouble. So we went there for an assessment. So they keep you in for 4 weeks and they basically assess you, because I was going through social services.
Mm.
So we used to, the old Ballymun police station, I used to be up there late at night waiting on an out of hour social worker to bring me to a hostel in town to sleep overnight. So then I went to Michael's. After Michael's, I went to Trinity House, which is a young offender's home in Lusk. We spent 2 years of my life there, from 16 to 18. And then when I got out of there, the same. I came out of there and just came back to Ballymun, back to the same environment, start using again. And just...
What was it like in them facilities?
It was horrendous. Mm-hmm. I was bullied in Trinity House for 2 years.
Were you hit by an officer? Or,
no,
or,
no. What are kids that were there? Yeah, yeah. Because I'm a very soft person, and like me, ma and dad, although we'd have, you know, with the upbringing that I had, me ma and dad were really good to me,
yeah.
And I got a lot of love off me ma, and she taught me a lot of really good things in relation to qualities. And I was made to be in the culture and in the environment that I was in.
Yeah.
And mentally, it just broke me. Even then, when I was only like 16, and I was fit and strong. Believe me, it wasn't the fact that I wasn't physically able to manage myself. It was more mental, and it was more fear-based, that I was just afraid. Mm. And I got the lads seeing that. They spotted that in me.
Mm.
And it's like in the world. If a lion spots that you're injured, okay, or you have a little bit of a limp, it's gonna focus on you. And that's what happened. I got bullied for most of the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's sad when you think about, you know, kids getting bullied in school.
Mm.
So now you have your summer holidays, your midterm break, you go home after school. But in your situation, you were living with these lads 24 hours of the day, 365 days a year.
Yeah, every day.
You come out of that after 2 years, you know, I imagine the confidence, the self-esteem, or self-image is all very poor at that stage.
Ah, yeah, 100%. Yeah. Mentally, I was exhausted. I was literally exhausted. And I never forget, I used to lie in my room, in the unit, and I used to listen to Elton John a lot. I loved listening to Elton John, because it just took me away from, the music was an escape for me.
Mm.
And I used to dream again about, it's going to get better.
Mm.
It's going to be all right. And I had to comfort myself because I had nothing else.
Mm.
And it was really difficult. And yeah, when I think back, it was just really sad.
Mm.
Really hard sad, to manage, yeah. You know.
100%. Did you come home to your mum's gaff?
Yeah, so I came home to Ballymun after that, and I started using again. And then after that, then my mum and dad separated. My ma took me and my older sister with her. And my dad stayed in the family home with the two younger ones. Because, you know, my ma was real soft. And she just took care of me and my older sister. And then the girls were like daddy's girls. So we kept the two younger ones. And that was the separation. And that was the worst thing my ma could have done.
Mm.
because she literally, you know, got a flat with just us two, and it was like anything went. So the house was like, it was like Euston Station for addicts.
Was your mother in addiction too?
She was drinking, and she would have been taking certain substances from time to time.
So she
would have been in addiction at some level.
And were you able to use in the house then as well?
100%. Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, that's in front of us. Yeah. Goes without saying, really, doesn't
it? Yeah,
because you're both enabling each other, like, at that stage, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Ma was doing the best that she could, and she was trying to give us what we needed. And then, obviously, she felt guilty at some level that she had to leave the family home, so she had her own demons to cope with, and she was hurting, and she was struggling with her own, you know, her own stuff, so... I'm sure it was really hard for me, Ma, to manage.
Of course.
And then she two, like, literally two adults, young adults that hadn't grown up yet and were actively using and robbing, and the police were kicking the door in regularly, and it was just, it was horrendous.
Yeah. And when we talk, when we look back and talk about our stories, inevitably it's going to come up about our parents, you know?
Yeah.
And it's never blaming.
No,
it's always like they have their own stories, and who wants to be a parent and raise a child that ends up a drug addict and somebody goes to prison? Nobody. But it's just the way things happen.
Yeah.
You know, and it, everybody would wish for it to be better, you know. But I still, when I talk about my stories, you know, I have a great relationship with my mum and dad today, you know what I mean? And they gave me a lot of love and affection and attention, and, you know, it turned out okay. You turned out okay. So they gave us that kind of good character. Or the qualities, like what you said earlier on, you know, it's just being able to navigate that, you know, and give you the smarts to navigate it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, you look back, it's never like, oh, it's my mum and dad's fault, or it's Ballymun's fault. It's not like, it's just, this is my story, you know what I mean? And it's neither good nor bad. This is just facts, like.
It's a complete lack of education as well, and understanding and awareness on people's, and there's no one to blame. If you, like, I hadn't got the awareness to know that I was doing wrong when I was fucking all over the place, and I used to let young kids. I didn't understand the consequences of my actions would affect my child later on in life, you know. And I'm sure down the line she might come to me and say, "Dad, you know, when I was small or three or four or wherever this happened, you know, these are just things that we don't understand." And as James said, there's never anybody to blame. You know, sometimes you're merely lucky to have a really difficult childhood or upbringing, because it pushes you to develop yourself a little bit more and go on to some form of spiritual path or whatever and become more in tuned and find your authentic self and live a fulfilled life and feel and find a job that you like that actually works for you, you know. Sometimes I've often thought about, do you know what, no, if I didn't have that really traumatic childhood, God, I probably wouldn't have become an addict, and I would have probably went on to be a right boring fucker that played golf or something like that. No disrespect to anyone that plays golf. Do you know, but I just can't phantom myself just doing things like that. It's just, I enjoy my life. I enjoy being 100 miles an hour, but not all the time.
Yeah.
Do you know, I do enjoy it, but yeah, but fuck it. I believe it. I believe that situations in our lives do push us into finding out there's more there. There's more there. Like your own journey, you know, and my journey and James's and everybody that's here, their own little journey, yeah. You know, but
when we started to move around the small bit, so you come out of the Borstals and the homes, and you come back and you're using in your mother's apartment, your mother's flat. Obviously trouble starts happening again because it's hand in hand with addiction.
Mm.
Did you end up start going into the adults' prison then, and that life began?
Yeah, yeah. We was in Pats, Mountjoy, Weefield, Cork Prison. We was in the mall and spent most of my life in there, in and out, because I would have been at the start. I got a long sentence when I was younger, and then I suppose as my addiction took hold of me, the offences or the crime that I was doing was just, I was just robbing to feed me habit. Basically, I wasn't any big cheese or anything like that. I was just basically robbing anything that I could to get the next few quid to get myself either a rock or a bag of bleeding gear or tablets or whatever it was he needed. So, and then prison was just part of that process for
me. Like an occupational hazard for somebody in addiction.
100%. So it was like, and I used to come back to this area, and luckily, I suppose, when I look back, luckily for me, I never lasted too long when I got out of prison, because my using was so chaotic that I would just go back to using intravenously, and I would go like bad really quick, and I'd be caught doing something, and I was never good at robbing. It was fucking a disaster. Hence why I spent most of my life in prison. Do you know what I mean?
But yeah, it sounds like prison was also that kind of saviour, that respite from the lifestyle. You know, if you were that chaotic user, and I was one of them users as well that was chaotic, that if we did stay in that chaotic use for a good length of time, that the possibilities of overdose or death, you know, was there. But prison, it sounds like prison really kind of stepped into your life at the right times, just to get you out of your environment, to get you some form of rehabilitation physically.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. The break was great, and the training, the field, the rest, it was just great. It just gave me that break that I needed, and I could kind of have some quality of life, even though I'd no freedom. But I enjoyed being able to train and able to do certain things. And I suppose I just got used to not having freedom. It was just part and parcel of my life. It was something I accepted about the way my life was. It was like, I'm going to have to go in here and do what I need to do in relation to prison. And that's the way it was.
And there'll be a lot of people watching this in that very situation. They're either waiting on a court case coming up, or they're in prison, because the podcast is shown in prisons now as
Brilliant.
Well. So there's going to be some people, so many men and women will be able to identify with you. That cycle of drugs, prison, getting out, getting released, but having charges pending. So, you know, you're going back, so you don't give a fuck. And then, you know, you have a small charge, so then you're going back anyway, and you start picking up all this mentality and not having the belief that you can actually be anything or do anything when you get out. That's a very hard cycle to break. How did you manage to break it? What happened towards the end?
Yeah. So what happened for me was, I obviously started off using very young. So by the time I was 19, I was introduced to recovery. So one of my good friends, Willa, was in recovery at that time. And other people that I knew were starting to get clean. And it was kind of, it was something that I was seeing, and I didn't necessarily want it. So when I was 19, I got clean. It was my first time getting clean. And I went to detox, and then I went to a place called Keltoy in the Phoenix Park, and I done my recovery treatment. Stayed there for 8 weeks in the Phoenix Park. It was bleeding great. We had our own personal trainer, counselling sessions every day. Massive field, lovely garden to walk around in. Like, it was unreal. And I met a girl, actually, the first time I was in treatment. I met a girl in there from, she was a posh girl from Nice. And I ended up being with her. Because I was a fucking, you know, I was doing stuff that you weren't supposed to do. They'd say, you can't do that. And I'd say, I can. So me and her, I remember kissing her near the end of my time there. And then I met her when we got out. And I was in recovery for a year. I was totally abstinent for a year, and I was going to meetings, and I wasn't living a spiritual way of life. I was up to all sorts, and I was causing myself and other people a lot of harm through my behaviours. And I was miserable. I was in a lot of pain. And eventually the time came where, I'll never forget it, I was walking through town one day. I was heading back to the recovery house I was in, because I lived with a load of lads. And I was coming through Fishbrough, and my mind just says to me, Shawnee, you should just get a bag of gear now. Stop all this pain. And I just walked straight to the bus stop in Fishbrough, got on a tour then, and went to Ballymun. And I was literally sitting on the bus, and I was thinking, my heart was screaming at me, saying, Shawnee, don't.
Yeah.
And my head was that savage. And I just felt so bad about myself. That I literally just couldn't tune into that part of my soul that was telling me, Shawnee, don't do it. And I literally sat in that bus with that, and had that battle. all the way to Ballymun, and we got off the bus and went over and I scored, and I didn't want to bleed and get it. I'll never forget it. We walked. I knew exactly where to go. I hadn't forgot. Knocked on the same door, scored a bag of gear, smoked it, and that was it. I was back using for like 9 years.
Mm. Do you think the reason you probably didn't listen to this side of your heart is because outside of being away from alcohol and drugs, you were still had some behaviours that you knew were wrong. You know, you weren't on that spiritual journey.
Exactly. 100% to me. Yeah. Definitely.
You need to be all in, don't you?
All in. Yeah. And I was trying to be, I was basically living against me values. And my soul was constantly saying to me, Shonny, this is not right for you.
Yeah.
And I was just so, I suppose, damaged, if you like, that I needed some type of pleasure to keep me going. So I was using all of this external stuff like sex, clothes, escapes, different forms of escape, social media, whatever it was. I don't think there was social media back then. It wasn't big anyway. So that's what I done. And then, you know, we would have kind of been good at talking about recovery. So I'd sit in meetings and I'd be able to quote different things and I'd sound really well in the meeting. But outside of the meeting, I was literally nothing. I had no real growth, if you get me.
Yeah.
I was just like an empty vessel and I was like kind of sharing, trying to keep myself going. So I was getting like two meetings a day. I was doing secretary. I was doing as much as I possibly could.
Sounds like me when I came back from France, when I was in treatment in France. It sounds the exact same thing. I was just kind of just doing it. I wasn't in it. I was just kind of basically doing it and basically dragging my arse along the floor, really.
Yeah.
You know, with the hope that something might happen. But looking back now, I had a lot more pain to get into, like, before I was ever to get into recovery like I am now at the moment, you know.
So when you spoke about there, going on the bus to Ballymun, knowing you shouldn't be doing it, you know, it fucking conflicting, you know, you want to get the gear, but you know, and the guilt that brings up in your brain brought me back to multiple times I locked myself into a bedroom for cold turkey for 4 or 5 days. And on the fifth or sixth day, you're injecting the drugs and the tears are all down your face and you're doing it. Or you're smoking the tray and the guilt that you have. You're just after putting yourself through 5 days hell. No sleep, shitting, fucking pissing and gawking. The insomnia used to drive me mad, the coldness in the body. You might get through that, man, and the sixth day then you're using. And it's like, what the fuck are you doing? And I could, you know, brought it all back there. It's just a very, very dark place to be, you know. And there's so many people like that today.
Yeah.
But eventually, I don't know what it is, eventually you'll get it, like, you know, no matter how many times that happens, yeah, you have to keep going and keep going and keep going. And we all, now I can get recovery first time around at all, and a lot of different treatment centres, a lot of cold turkeys, relapsed every time, went through that guilt over and over and over again, back into prison thinking, oh, here we go again, the same landings, the same officers, the same conversations on the yard, the same game of Dan, the same ham. You know, the officers are getting younger, you're getting older, you know. But eventually you'll get it. And eventually you got it.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little about how you got it, how that came about, what age you were maybe?
Yeah, so I was 30 when I finally got clean, for real. And I think the process from when I went back to that time, for that whole time, I was experiencing like a fourth step in my soul, where I was homeless, I was sleeping on the streets, I was like a down and out, proper down and out. And that voice in my soul was getting louder. The worse I was getting physically, mentally, and spiritually, the louder that voice in my soul was getting. And it was saying, Johnny, you need to do something. And it was like tug of war with that. And then eventually I turned into a real loner then later on in addiction, where I was just constantly on my own and I was really depressed and suicidal and lost. Like anybody that knows me, I'll tell you, they used to see me walking around with a bag on my back, on my own, just marching. And like I said, I was homeless a lot of the time. I lived with Peter McFerry for a lot of my life. But there was phases in that where I was really chaotic, where I couldn't even live in his place. So at the end, I got this night in particular, loads of different, I had an experience in Ballymun one day, with a couple of different big experiences that happened to me. So out here one day, I was selling stuff in the Towers pub. I was trying to get the money up for a rock. I was strung out the bits on crack at the time. And a lot of lads that I used to score off, these were the boys. And they were only young kids. And I was like probably 28. And I was broken. And I was in the Tower selling stuff. And one of the lads said something. And I said something back to him off the cuff. Didn't even realise what he said. And I went outside. And the three of them came out behind me. And they kicked me to a pulp for about 20 minutes. They kicked me from the Towers over to here, to the access centre. And I'll never forget it. And every time I was on the ground, I'd get clamber back up onto my feet and I'd go to run and one of them would catch me heel and I'd literally fall flat on my face and he'd boot me around again. And it was just really humiliating. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that experience of sitting on my own after that and thinking, this is not good.
Yeah.
Really bad, like. So that was one experience. And then the end of me using finished where both my sisters were actively using at the time. And they lived, one of them lived in a flat facing the old triangle and the other one lived in a flat in Fisbrough, or in Drumcondra. So they were like, one of them was here and one of them was there. And I was homeless at the time. And they had their own flats. And I was outside the centre on Dorset Street. My sister's flat in at the old triangle was probably like a 2 minute walk for me. My other sister's flat was a 5 minute walk. And I couldn't get myself up off the ground to go and ask them to help me or give me a cup of tea or give me a blanket or whatever. Give me a blade and a hug. I don't know. And I couldn't get up. I couldn't get off the fucking floor. My heart was broke.
Because we don't believe we deserve it.
Yeah. My fucking heart was broke. And I suppose in that moment I realised that all of the stuff externally that I'd been doing and all the things outside myself were no use to me. And I just had this moment in my heart where I was like, please God, help me. I beg you, help me. And I think something happened to me that day or that night. And from that day on then I started to ask people to help me. We start reaching out. We start trying to do stuff to enable me to get clean again. And that process was obviously long. But I was doing all the right stuff. And I was done. I knew my soul. I was done this time. I didn't want to be living like that anymore. And I suppose I got that. I had that kind of moment where I realised that I was good. I was a good person.
Yeah.
With a good heart, and I actually deserved better than what I was putting myself through. And that was it. That was the start of the recovery process for me. Mm. I was 29 then.
Mm.
And I got into detox, thank God.
Do you know when you spoke about the boys kicking you around the place? Like, I think I was telling Timmy a few weeks ago, you know, towards the end of the using day, I become so frail that I couldn't defend myself. And I remember getting a few belts off one fella. And I had two bags, no, two cues in my hand, you know, and I was thinking about it, I better not fucking drop these cues, yeah. You know. But I remember being humiliated at the same time and coming away thinking like, stay here, you can't even fucking stand up for yourself, you know. And that was towards the end as well, but there is little moments like that, but you're getting closer and closer to recovery every time something like that happens to you.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, it's so pathetic. You know, and we know we're better than that. We deserve better than this. We know deep down that we're good people and we don't deserve to be booted around like animals around the street, you know what I mean? And given a half a chance, we could actually do something with our lives. So that beating is probably, they did you a favour.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It goes from the beginning where it's fun, the drug addiction is fun, to where it's balanced for a while, to where it gets chaotic and these episodes start happening. Like, you know, I remember being inside in the shed as well, you know, being locked in the shed. My wife being inside in the house with the kids and I opened the shed and I just snorting cocaine for 3, 4, 5 days and just sitting there and praying, just praying to God, like, and just, why is my life like this? Why can't I stop? I'd be praying 1 minute, then 2 minutes later, I'm in the bag again. And, you know, and I'm taking tablets then to put me to sleep, and I'm back in the bag again. Like, it was just, it is the life of a drug addict, like.
Yeah.
There's no why or I can't explain it. It's just, yeah, that's what just happens. But going back, what happened, all these different things that happened. Like, that's one of the things I remember. I'll always remember that. And there's a few other things that really were the turning points for me. Like, this can't keep continuing. Like, you know, you're not just hurting yourself anymore. You have kids now as well, you know. And I got very emotional there when you were starting to talk about it, because I could see the emotion in your own face, you know, and I could feel your pain sitting on that floor, that concrete floor, like, and just trying to make pull this lonely feeling of, yeah, just knowing that you're on your own this time and nobody wants you, because you believe that nobody wants you anyway, you know, and then to be praying, and our prayers do get answered.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to take us up off the floor and put us in straight into a lovely warm house with a few million in the corner of the room, yeah, and just say, go on away, know about your business, you'll be grand. They're going to give you this little pat where they're going to help you here, help you the next step, and leave you grow slowly, you know. Like, it doesn't become brilliant all of a sudden. There's certain points where we really have to learn and grow as human beings to be able to handle the next step in life, the next journey, the next traumatic thing that happened in childhood, to be able to deal with that. And that's the journey of recovery. I was speaking to Willow earlier about it, you know, and that's how it actually works. Mm. It's not something like you win the lotto and you're taken off the streets. You're still left with all the mad stuff that we drink and drug on. But it's a journey, you know.
But, since the drugs, the prison and all that, the sadness has left your life. Now you're in recovery now multiple years. You've got a kid. You know, you're looking great. You know, you're happy. And what's life like for you at the moment?
Life's amazing at the moment, James. And we have a full life. We have the most amazing life. My story is really strange. I was in recovery for 8 or 9 years and I was really unhappy and I was suffering with my mental health. And I was trying to use recovery to fix that. And I was getting worse. And I was in a job that I hated. And I was in a relationship that wasn't working with my baby's mum. And it looked like I was going to lose my marbles, to be honest with you.
Mm.
And my family used to be saying, like, are you all right? Because I wear my heart on my sleeve. So if you meet me and I'm unwell, you'll now be looking at me. Because I'm one of them people that just can't hide it. So these people were seeing this in me. And it was the same as the addiction that it slowly wore me out. And I was in my job one day and that voice in my soul was saying to me, Shani, it's time to get out of here. You need to go, man. You need to start living. And I turned 40 and it was like somebody came into the flat and pressed the switch on the wall. And I had this thought. I was like, Shani, you need to start living. And I basically done what I needed to do in relation to my mental health. I had to go on medication, which is what I needed to do.
Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I needed to do that. And I spoke with my doctor and he told me what I needed to do. And believe me, I was dying on my feet. And I was a long time in recovery and I was literally dying on my feet. I was so, so sick. And I had no peace. But my relationships were all being impacted. And only for me baby, I don't know what would have happened to me. So I broke up with the baby's ma. And I left my job after 6 years. And I swear to God, it was like someone took a set of cuffs on me and set me free.
I actually done the same thing
as your
in recovery. I had to go to the doctor as well and be put on medication, you know. And because I was in the same place, I was 6 years in recovery, 7 years in recovery, and I felt like I just wanted to die.
Yeah.
I didn't feel, I was doing all the right things. On the outside, I looked like it was the perfect family, and where inside I was just dead. I was dull. I still felt like it was no good and all these different things, but I made a decision to go to a doctor. But from that decision, doors opened up for me because I made a decision to start working with a psychotherapist at the time. And I started learning a little bit about myself, you know, and I started going on different journeys in meditation and spirituality. And I went down the route of trying ayahuasca. I'd done all these different things. And that's when my life started to change. I started feeling love for myself and my family, you know. I just thought it was important that I come in and just let you know that I felt it the exact same way as you. Just because you're in recovery, you still feel like shit.
Yeah.
But what happened for you is you had to break away from that life. And there are things that we're actually afraid to do as well in recovery, like to break away from relationships and stuff, even, you know. But
you made a good point as well. Like, life was too short to be miserable in a job. You know, to be unhappy, like, you know, a bit of peace and happiness and contentment on social welfare is better than being miserable on a 70k
job. Yeah, you're on the ball.
Yeah. Well, that's the place I came to, James and myself, that I was suicidal. Like, I was getting suicidal thoughts, and I was in the job one day, and I thought, the last day I walked out of the job, I was sitting in a room in an induction with two people, and it was like a woman's lips were moving. But I couldn't hear an absolute thing. I was just, like you said to me, I was dull. Mm. Like, my head was just shut down. And I retreat into myself. And I survive. And I can't be in relationships with people. I've no coping skills. I've nothing. I'm just literally sitting there. And I got up and I says, I need to get some fresh air. And I walked outside. And in the job I was in, there's a big huge running track. And I stood looking down at the running track and I had this thought. I thought, I'm going to top myself. I can't do this anymore. That was the thought I had. And I'm 10 years in recovery and I thought, I'm going to get... I had my baby, Harper. Where's my case? Can you use that, Willa?
She's on your key ring.
So,
it's beautiful.
That's Harper Lily.
It's beautiful. So,
she's the reason why I'm breathing. She's the reason why I change so much things in my life. And she's me happy. Simple as that. Without her, I literally wouldn't have anything in my life. And she taught me what love really is.
She's lucky to have a father like you, believe me.
I walked out of the job, resigned, and I'd nothing, with no income, with no money, with loads of bills. We got a loan for a car, 15 grand. I was in debt to me rent. I was up against it. And I just thought, you know what, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care about money, about loans, about bills. I don't care about any of it. We just want to be alive. And I want to be able to spend time with my baby and be there for her, emotionally be able to be with her and cuddle her and comfort her and just give her my time. And that's what I done. I made that decision for me and Harper. And I swear to God, my life since that has been like a dream. I'm not joking with you. Sometimes I'd be standing in the house in my flat, or if I'm out running, or if I'm out doing events, and even like this morning with the guys, I'm like, is this really happening?
I'm kind of thinking, is there someone going to knock the lights off?
Yeah. But the lights have been turned on.
Do you know what I mean? Because I was living in that state of darkness for so long, when you're supposed to be happy and free, do you get me?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm kind of like, now, what's going on? And I'm slowly, but surely starting to really get comfortable with living with me, recognising that I have a mental health illness, recognising that I need to look after my soul, look after myself. And then obviously in turn, then I can be the best daddy. And I mean, my relationship with Harper is priceless. Like, she loves her daddy. She cuddles me every time she sees me. She runs out of crash, jumps in my arms. Daddy, daddy, daddy. She kisses me. She comes up beside me. She always comes up beside me and she holds onto my leg and puts her cheek on my leg. She says, I love you, daddy. And I think that's what it's about. That's what life's about. It's about who. It's about having that connection. And it's not about all the external stuff. As long as I can have that bond with her, you know, everything else is like second to that. So yeah, it's amazing. My life is amazing.
And that's a great way to finish. Zanano talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks James. Thanks to me.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I think you're just after opening up a lot of people's eyes that are going to be listening to this about what's really important in life. You know, it's not about the job. It's not about living in that miserable job that you just dread going into every single day. It's about making that decision, you know, and feeling that fear that's stopping you from going out the door inside in that job, our relationship, and living for the things that you really care for, you know. And I got very emotional because I have young kids as well. And I think I have a few things as well, because I'm kind of caught up in the job as well. I'm starting a new business and it's taking up a lot of my time and my wife's time. And my kids are a little bit older, but I know they're after getting all the love and care and attention that they needed off my wife. Or I mightn't have been there as much as I would have loved to, because of my own being caught up in addiction and in prison and different stuff. Like, but I know, like, how important they are to me. Like, and I could see it in your face, the love that you have for that child. And it's amazing. I just want to wish you all the best, Shawnee.
Thanks a million, Timmy.
Thanks a million.
Thanks, James.
God bless.
Thanks.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.